Hi, everybody. Welcome to North Coast Chronicles podcast, Tales from the Great Lakes. I'm your host, Helen Pearl. Please join me every month on the American Shoreline Podcast Network as we share the nature, history, folklore, and charm of the Great Lakes, America's fourth seacoast. This holiday podcast is called The Christmas Tree Ship and Christmas Tree Santas of Chicago. With us is Dr. Ted Karamanski, a history professor at Loyola University Chicago and author of at least a dozen books, many about Chicago and regional maritime history. Welcome, Ted.
Thank you.
And also with us is Captain Scott Smith, Senior Vice President of Marine Operations for Hornblower Group and previous captain on the Coast Guard Cutter Mackinac. Hi, Captain Scott.
Hello, Helen. It's always great to be with you.
Thank you. And with us, as always, is our trusty engineer, Tyler Buckingham. Hi, Tyler. What's shaking?
Hey, Helen. Greetings from sunny California.
Ooh, excellent. Well, so Tyler has been a great partner on North Coast Chronicles. Fun to talk to, and actually, I like teasing him a little bit. One of the other hosts on the American Shoreline Podcast Network, Admiral Tim Gallaudet, who does the Blue Economy show, called me to tell me that he so enjoyed our banter on North Coast Chronicles that he decided that doing his year in review show would be much more fun if he did it talking with you, Tyler. And I think that's very cool and very sweet. So how did that go?
Well, it was, of course, an honor to be asked to do it by Admiral Gallaudet, and I thought it went very well. I personally had a great time, and it was fun to go through kind of a year in review of what he covered on his show in 2021.
Well, he was so interesting. He was driving somewhere, and he called me, and we had this long conversation about the work he's doing and stuff going on and the podcast and how much he enjoys it. But it was interesting because he said, I really love what you do with Tyler on your shows. I can't believe how you choreograph it all. And I'm like, well, we don't choreograph it at all. I mean, I just throw whatever at Tyler, and Tyler just bounces back and does such a great job. And I will say it really is just a pleasure to do it. And I thought it was very, it said a lot about you, Tyler, that he wanted to do something with you too. So perhaps that's a whole nother career for you as well.
Well, that's very kind of you, Helen.
So on this show, we don't have a year in review, but in thinking back on our first six podcasts, I really am grateful for the opportunity to work with you, Tyler, and the American Shoreline Podcast Network, and to share my love of the Great Lakes through North Coast Chronicles. I don't know if anybody has listened to every single podcast other than you and I, Tyler, and my sister-in-law, Linda, but people often reference one or another of our shows, which is very rewarding. One of our previous guests, Belle Bachman, mentioned she would never pass up an opportunity to talk about the Welland Canal. Well, I feel the same about every chance to share about the wonderful Great Lakes resource. I'm an admitted Great Lakes gal, and I hope that Tyler is starting to feel like a Great Lakes guy.
No doubt about it.
The American Shoreline Podcast Network and Coastal News Today was established to support the success of shoreline professionals and empower an informed coastal citizenry, illuminating divergent viewpoints among coastal interests and advancing the understanding of our vital ocean and inland resources. North Coast Chronicles, as well as other shows on the network, rely upon advertising and sponsorship to keep coastal news and entertainment in the forefront. Please consider supporting any of the great catalog of shows on ASPN by contacting us at coastalnewstoday.com/advertising. Today's podcast, let me give you the facts up front. So once upon a time, I worked at the Chicago Port District, which is one of 19 public port districts in Illinois. The Port District is really a subset of what you might consider the greater port and harbor of Chicago. It's probably no surprise that Chicago was founded at the mouth of the river on Lake Michigan by an 18th century fur trapper. That river, subsequently called the Chicago River, set the stage for Chicago becoming a center of commercial shipping. Now, what that shipping looks like today has changed over the years, and that's really kind of a conversation about the evolution of the national and international supply chain. But in any case, Chicago was a distribution point for fur traders from the upper Midwest. Later, Midwestern farmers and lumber producers shipped their products east from the Port of Chicago. Chicago's geographic location affords it the ability to handle waterborne commerce via the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Seaway and with domestic shipping by barge down the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal and the Illinois River to the Mississippi River all the way to New Orleans. Until well into the 20th century, most cargo was handled right on the Chicago waterfront and along the Chicago River. Today, the ships that come to Chicago via the Seaway go to terminals on the south side of Chicago, on and around the Calumet River, where I worked. Our loyal podcast listeners have been learning bits and pieces of the history of shipping in the Great Lakes. On our second podcast, I interviewed my brother, Captain Russ Brohl, who talked about being a freighter captain on the Great Lakes. And on our fifth podcast, called The Great Portage of 1829, we talked about the building of the Welland Canal around Niagara Falls, while acknowledging that numerous Indian tribes inhabited and traversed the Great Lakes region long before the arrival of French explorers in the 17th century. Commercial shipping, even international shipping, on the Great Lakes has been going on for a long time. Over the past 100 years or so, domestic shipping, or the carriage of cargo around the Great Lakes without ever leaving the Great Lakes, tends to be iron ore, taconite, grain, salt, and other bulk cargoes. The trade of Christmas trees from the Upper Lakes to Chicago is a very interesting story, one that started in the 19th century and continues today. As I noted, Dr. Ted Karamanski is a history professor with Loyola University, Chicago. When I lived in Chicago over 30 years ago, I was on the board of the Chicago Maritime Society, and Dr. Ted was well known even back then as an expert on Chicago maritime history. What I only recently learned is that he is an expert on lighthouses as well. In our last podcast, The Silent Watchkeepers, Lighthouses of the Great Lakes, we talked about how Michigan had more lighthouses than any other state. Dr. Karamanski, without diverting from today's subject too much, can I ask you what drew you to the subject of lighthouses in particular, and do you have a favorite?
Well, Helen, back in the days when we were working together to create a maritime museum in Chicago, an effort that did end up taking about 30 years, we did an exhibit on lighthouses of Illinois at that first maritime museum we were able to develop at the North Pier. And so that first got me interested in the subject. But my most recent book, Mastering the Inland Seas, about lighthouses on the Great Lakes, that grew out of an effort of the National Park Service, because, you know, they're decommissioning the lighthouses, and some are being sold off, others being given to local historical societies. But in the course of doing all that, the National Park Service has a responsibility to make sure that any historic landmarks aren't going to be neglected. And so I did a project for them to determine, how do you determine if a lighthouse has something to do in an important way with the history of the nation?
Wow. Well, congratulations. I'm not surprised that you got the job. I think we learned in our last podcast that there's about 700 lighthouses in the U.S. And I did note also that on the Coast Guard website, you can Google it, there is a list, an alphabetical listing of every lighthouse in the United States. And we did also learn about how you could buy one and the challenges of buying one, the historical responsibilities, and at least two lighthouses that are being now managed and restored by the Great Lakes Lighthouse Keepers Association. But thank you for that work. Well, you know, the subject comes full circle on the show because I know Captain Scott Smith from his past life in the Coast Guard when he worked at Coast Guard headquarters on aids to navigation. And what is a lighthouse if not an aid to navigation? Captain Scott, I want you to know that at the last show, I did give you and all of your colleagues a shout out in federal government who work domestically and internationally to support the safety of navigation in U.S. waters, you being one of them. So having sailed the lakes and having seen a lot of lighthouses from the water, do you have a favorite?
I actually have two. And one is Split Rock Lighthouse up in Lake Superior in the western end. I just think that's a majestic lighthouse that sits on that cliff overlooking Lake Superior and just is absolutely gorgeous. And the other one is Marblehead Lighthouse in Ohio. And that's for more personal reasons, as I proposed to my wife at the base of that lighthouse.
Oh, so there's a romantic story to it, too. That's so sweet. How nice. Yeah, I've met your wife. She is a dear, and that's a lovely story. Now, when I lived in Chicago, I learned of a famous artist named Charles Vickery. And Charles Vickery was an American painter best known for his realistic depictions of historic ships in the open ocean and crashing waves and all types of weather and times of day. And also, he did a lot of Great Lakes ship pictures. Now, one could buy prints of his paintings back then, and he would sign his name in addition to the printed version. At that time, I purchased one of the Christmas Tree Ship of Chicago. And it's a print that I have framed, and every holiday in December, I take down whatever I have on the mantle, and I put that painting up, and it is there today. And I am so charmed by this painting. But it also just evokes a lot of curiosity about the Christmas Tree Ship. mean, what is it? And why is it magical? And what is the folklore around it? And so thanks to our guest today to help us kind of venture into that for the holiday. Dr. Karamanski, can you tell us a little bit about the history, perhaps, you know, the schooners, and how did this all kind of happen back in the 1800s?
Well, it came about initially, it's near the end of the sailing ship era. You know, schooners were sort of the covered wagons of the Great Lakes frontier back in the early 19th century. But by the time we get to the 1870s, steam vessels are beginning to erode the importance of schooners. Back in 1873, there was a major depression, the Panic of 1873, it was called. And a lot of the owners of these schooner vessels came up short in making enough revenue to meet their costs. And so several of them undertook late season voyages with either potatoes or Christmas trees for one last chance to kind of balance the books. And that's the beginning of the Christmas tree story on Lake Michigan.
Wow. Well, you know, gotta be creative in the maritime business, right? Marketplaces change and things change. So were there like a whole slew of schooners that got into the business?
Yes, that's true. And of course, Christmas trees were brought by schooners to other places than Chicago, to Milwaukee, to Cleveland, and so forth, on an intermittent basis. But for Chicago, beginning in 1876, it was pretty much an annual thing. In 1876, the schooner that brought Christmas trees to Chicago was perfectly named the Reindeer.
Oh, that's pretty charming. So when these ships showed up and they were full of Christmas trees, I mean, did they sell them off the boat? Was there a distributor? How did they get out and about? How did people buy them?
Yeah, the basic idea is the ship would dock on the Chicago River, and eventually Clark Street Bridge became the place where this was most frequently done. And they would sell the trees from the deck. Also, they would hire young girls to take some of the trees apart and make wreaths. And then they would sell Christmas wreaths also from the ship. And after a while, this became quite a tradition to go dockside and shop for a wreath or bring your kids down for Christmas to buy a Christmas tree.
That just sounds so nostalgic and sweet. What a great story. But where, like, was there certain places on the Upper Lakes, or where in particular did they pick up these trees?
You could get them at a number of places. The Door Peninsula was one location, and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, particularly the far northern shore of the lake around the harbor of Manistique, Michigan.
So were these ships like independently owned? Were they, you know, owned by one company or independently owned? How were they kind of managed?
Yeah, these were ships that were independently owned. And it was not uncommon that someone who wants to market, say, Christmas trees would actually rent a ship for one voyage and take it up to northern Michigan and northern Wisconsin, get the Christmas trees, come back down, sell them from the dock, dress up like Santa Claus dockside. But they wouldn't necessarily own the vessel. They might have just leased it.
Yeah, like a modern day charter. You know, just renting the space. And then but they would rent it with the crew and the captain all together, right?
Or they would recruit their own crew. Sometimes the crew were people who were also tasked with cutting down the Christmas trees.
Oh, that's interesting. So when they would go up north, we're talking about schooners, right? So they're like, how big are we kind of thinking? How long?
We're talking about a vessel about 125, 135 feet in length, usually three-masted. And of course, it's a schooner because the sails are set parallel to the hull, as opposed to when you think of a classic ocean-going vessel, where the sails are set from spars perpendicular to the hull.
Oh, Okay, thank you. I mean, when you see a schooner and they say it's a schooner, it looks exactly like you're talking, but I think we forget to like define it. And, you know, a lot of people look at a sailing ship and think they're all the same, and we logically know they're not, but we don't define it. And so why did schooners, do you know why schooners in particular worked well on the Great Lakes?
Yes. It had a lot to do with both economy and sailing conditions. Schooners could sail very close to the wind, particularly with a good centerboard to help keep them stable when they were tacking against the wind. But also, because the main sails of a schooner could be set from the deck, unlike in a square-rigged sailing ship, your men have to go aloft and crawl out along the spars and let the sails drop down or bring them up. This all could be done from the deck on a schooner, so you needed a much smaller crew. 5, 6, 7 people would be more than enough for a schooner, whereas if that was a square-rigged vessel, you're talking 12, 15.
Oh, yeah, that makes so much sense. Now, were these, did they have the hatch or the hull and the hold, I guess that's what I'm trying to say. The hold, were they just like lowered down into the hold? And how did they do that? By just literally, in the old days, they didn't really have cranes, right? So they were literally just lowering them down, or did they literally just wrap them and throw them, or how did they load the ship?
Well, certainly for the Christmas trees, they're just jamming them into the hold. And Christmas tree ship, in order to make it an economic venture, every inch of that hold would be full of trees. And then oftentimes they would lash all available deck space with more trees.
Absolutely. It's like if folks look at container ships, you know, the ship, you know, you see them and they all seem piled up. They all go down into the hold, but then they pile them up on top as high as they can go, feasibly go. Also, just it's all about taking advantage of the space that you have. Now, did they combine cargoes at all, you know, do you know, with the Christmas tree ships, or did they really just, for the most part, when it was Christmas tree ship time, that's what they did?
It was pretty much just Christmas trees. Now, another way to, in a late season, to maybe make a little money, particularly if you owned the vessel, you might also go up to northern Michigan or Wisconsin and with a load of potatoes and take that into a city and then just dock your vessel. And over the course of the winter, sell your cargo of potatoes to various restaurants who would require that vegetable. But Christmas trees, it was mainly with Christmas trees. It was mainly just Christmas trees.
So if they went up to the Upper Peninsula or UP, where did they dock? These are sailing ships, and how did they do that? Were there like a port area to go into?
Sure. In the case of the famous Christmas tree ship, the Rouse Simmons, she went ahead and went from the Chicago River north to Manistique, Michigan, where there was a crude harbor that had been roughed out by the Army Corps of Engineers. After the Civil War, prior to the Civil War, all along the Great Lakes, there really were no harbors of refuge or even small commercial harbors. And the whole conditions of docking in various places was extremely difficult. But after the Civil War, the government really got into seriously improving navigation safety. So they were able to dock in a regular harbor at Manistique and send the men out into the forest to harvest the trees.
Wow. I love the historical sense of timelines on the development of our waterfronts, certainly, and in the Great Lakes. I didn't even think about that timeline, Civil War, post-Civil War, where we started to really think about our formal navigation projects and Army Corps developing the ports. So that's actually very interesting. So you mentioned the Rouse Simmons. The Rouse Simmons does have a lot of history around it and a lot of folklore around it. Why does the Rouse Simmons stick out of a Christmas tree ship?
Well, she was one of the last of the Christmas tree ships that would make the voyage from Chicago all the way up Lake Michigan, the entire length of Lake Michigan, of course, well over 200 miles. She would go for her voyages. And tragically, in 1912, the vessel perished in making that. Pretty much after that, there were a couple of other ships that were chartered after that, but they then began to bring the Christmas trees in by train, by rail, and then load them onto a vessel just to kind of keep the pretense of the tradition alive. So she's kind of known as the last of the Christmas tree ships.
And was there a captain, a specific captain of the Rouse Simmons?
Yeah, the man who chartered the Rouse Simmons was a fellow by the name of August Schunemann, an immigrant from Germany who had deep roots and experience sailing the Great Lakes. He had many times been master of his own vessel. In the case of the Rouse Simmons, however, he chartered that along with its captain, Captain Nelson. The two of them undertook this last voyage in November of 1912.
So the schooner was still operating in 1912.
Absolutely. In fact, the last of the Great Lakes schooners was really in commercial use as opposed to some kind of recreational use, was the vessel Our Son, which lasted on Lake Michigan till 1933.
I find that amazing. But I guess if it's working, well, if it's not broke, don't fix it. So that's really interesting. So Captain Schunemann from the Rouse Simmons, I read that he was kind of known as the Christmas tree Santa. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's the way the local newspapers portrayed him. And he seems to have relished the role as well.
So give me an example. Like, I mean, you talked a little bit about they would dock and then people would come to pick up trees and wreaths. But like, give me a sense of a little bit of the celebration around that. A bit of that, I don't know, the history. What did it mean? I'm just trying to get a sense, because to me, it's kind of a charming part of the past. Because I'm trying to understand, because it's kind of come back a little bit, at least symbolically, in today. So is there a sense of, you know, what Chicago is like? I mean, you know so much about Chicago and Chicago history and Chicago maritime history. Like, where did that fit, do you think, within Chicago maritime history?
One of the things about the Christmas tree ships, I think it's useful to keep in mind, is that it's part of the evolution of Christmas becoming a major holiday. The Puritan founders of much of America frowned on the idea of any kind of celebration of Christmas. And so it was German Americans who brought the tradition of the Christmas tree to the United States. And so it's significant that the Schunemanns were German immigrants. Who saw this opportunity to popularize the use of Christmas trees as a symbol of the season, and then, of course, find a way to make money off it.
It's a really lovely story, and how, you know, the immigrants brought the Christmas tree tradition, and how that kind of evolved out of the Christmas tree ships and trade in Great Lakes shipping. I'd like to ask Captain Scott Smith with us. And Captain Smith, before I ask you a little bit about how you became a modern day Christmas tree Santa, tell me a little bit about your work with the U.S. Coast Guard. I met you, as I said before, when you were in Washington, D.C. We kept up the friendship when you began to captain the Coast Guard cutter Mackinac. And I'm grateful that we keep in touch today. But tell me a little bit about your work, and then I want to talk a little bit about the Mackinac.
Absolutely. So, you know, I started back in 1990 after I graduated the Coast Guard Academy. I was serviced in the Coast Guard up in the Great Lakes. I was on the Bramble as a junior officer, which is a buoy tender out of Port Huron, Michigan. And then after that tour, went to Cleveland, which is the Great Lakes headquarters for the Coast Guard. Worked in the Aids and Navigation Office up there, and then went executive officer up in Duluth, Minnesota on the Sundew, which still plies the water up there, although in a private capacity. And then ventured off to different places within the Coast Guard and eventually came back to the Coast Guard or to the Great Lakes as the commanding officer of the Mackinac. But after that, I went back to headquarters, as my wife said, to serve my penance for being afloat. And my position there over the last 6 years was very in-depth involved with AIDS navigation, bridges, really the marine transportation system within the U.S. And, of course, obviously here in the Great Lakes. I was also the U.S. consul to IALA, which is the International Association of AIDS Navigation and Lighthouse Authorities, which I know that you mentioned on your last podcast, which I did listen to, which is very informative about lighthouses. So that you know, bring me full circle from really starting my career servicing AIDS navigation and then ending my career being the chief of navigation for the Coast Guard and then responsible for the navigation, AIDS navigation, as well as multiple other marine transportation efforts.
Yeah, thanks so much. And thanks for your service. And it can't be said enough that these folks kind of behind the scenes who are taking care of the safety of navigation in U.S. waters, it's not just the safety things, it also keeps our environment safe and protected. So thank you so much for that. Now then, you went on the Coast Guard cutter Mackinac, which I think is the biggest Coast Guard cutter in the Great Lakes anyway. Tell us a little bit about the Mackinac and a little bit of brag on some of your firsts that you did on the Mackinac.
Oh, absolutely. So Mackinac, the current Mackinac, is the second Coast Guard vessel to have that name. First, of course, is the very historic, very important cutter Mackinac, which would be the WAGB 83, which is currently a museum up in Mackinac City and probably incredibly famous throughout the Great Lakes. And her sole mission was icebreaking in the Great Lakes. And she was decommissioned in 2006. Built for World War II, built in World War II to help facilitate commerce and goods being shipped from the Northern Lakes down through the St. Mary's River down to ports both Lake Erie and in Lake Michigan to make sure our steel was available to build wartime requirements or meet wartime requirements. The new Mackinac was commissioned in 2006. She is WLBB 30, and she is a not only the largest domestic icebreaker we currently have. She's a little bit smaller than the old Mackinac, but she is very different. The old Mackinac, somewhere around 12,000 horsepower. The new Mackinac is roughly 10,000 horsepower, and she is azipod driven, so very uniquely different than anything else in the Coast Guard, really in the military service side of the U.S. today. Azipod, or basically, if you think about the 4,200 horsepower motors that can rotate 360 degrees at the stern of the vessel, makes her incredibly maneuverable, both from an icebreaking perspective and ship handling perspective. So she is very unique, has an integrated bridge system, all the bells and whistles of the modern day bridge up on her bridge for her crew to control her.
You know, when I lived in Chicago, I got on the old Mackinac, but I have to say I haven't been on the new Mackinac, which I find kind of interesting. I don't know why that happened that I haven't been on it. But she is a beautiful ship, I have to say. And the reason I asked Captain Smith to talk about some of his firsts is that when he was on the Mackinac, he went into folks, on my previous podcast, I mentioned that I'm from the islands in Lake Erie, and I'm from Middle Bass Island, and next door to Middle Bass Island is South Bass Island and the Bay of Put-in Bay. And Scott, I think you were the first person to bring the Mackinac in, right? I mean, you might have had an undercook clearance of inches.
I was, thankfully, and through proper planning and Mother Nature helping us, we were in a very high state of lake level. I think we were plus 48 inches at that point, which allowed us to go in more up in Put-in Bay on South Bass Island, not twice. I had the distinction of bringing the largest vessel into that port that you could possibly get in there. And we did fit like a glove. And but I was very honored to do that. I've sailed all the four Great Lakes on that vessel. Did not get into Lake Ontario, which I wish I would have. That vessel have been on others, but yeah, it was having that vessel was a very unique opportunity.
How many icebreakers does Coast Guard have in the Great Lakes total?
It's seven total. Actually, if you count the 225s, there's nine total. There's six 140-foot icebreakers, the Mackinac, and then two 225s, one home-ported in Port Huron, Michigan, the other one home-ported up in Duluth, Minnesota.
You talked about how unique the Mackinac, the new Mackinac is, and how efficient it is. But have you ever been stuck in the ice?
I've never gotten stuck in the ice. The ice has stopped us, but didn't necessarily make us stuck. So I have had conditions even on the new Mackinac that did stop us. We just had to back out. And uniquely enough, she breaks ice back better backwards than forwards. When you put that those blades into the ice and chew that up, she makes slushies come out the other side. And she does a wonderful job in close and in personal breaking the ice.
So why do we need ice breaking? I mean, when the Great Lakes in the wintertime, it just shuts down, right? Isn't that the case? I mean, wouldn't you just leave it alone and wait till it thaws in the spring? Why do we need icebreakers?
It is definitely not the case. So moving commerce on the Great Lakes is a full-time 12-month a year proposition. The locks do close up in both the Welland, which you discussed before, and in Sault Ste. Marie at the Sioux Locks. Those close, but there is shipping on the lower lakes between Lake Huron, Lake Michigan, Lake Erie that continue throughout the season. It is important that we move that commerce. I know there is iron ore move from Escanaba, Michigan, down the lower lakes. There's steel coil moved from Sioux down to the lower lakes. There's salt that's much needed for road conditions up here in the Midwest, moved from different various ports, both on the U.S. and Canadian side to various large cities. So there's commerce that still moves on the Great Lakes, and then it's Coast Guard's responsibility to make sure that commerce is viable and can proceed.
Thank you. How is it that you actually became a Christmas tree Santa?
Well, I would tell you that the modern Christmas tree ship started back in 2000. It was a group of Chicagoans, both from the Navy League and the Shipmasters Association down there, that tried to get this started back in the late 1990s. And the original thought was to have a commercial ship bring the trees in. Unfortunately, that wasn't viable, so they approached the Coast Guard to see if they'd be willing to do this. And that's where the Coast Guard Mackinac, the Cutter Mackinac, the original, got involved in her last couple of years. And so she was the original Christmas tree ship, a modern Christmas tree ship. And then with the replacement of the old Mackinac with the new Mackinac, they took over. I was the captain on the new Mackinac from 2008 to 2011. And was very blessed to have participated in this adventure. So we have business down in southern Lake Michigan during this time of year. We do a lot of aids and aviation, pulling buoys for the winter so that the large buoys with expensive lights on them don't get crushed by the ice. And so we replaced a lot of those with winter marks. And so in doing that, we were able to come down to Lake Michigan in the pursuit of our federal requirements and be able to deliver those trees at the same time.
Well, it's a great story. So who pays for these trees? How do you get them and where do you put them on the boat? It's not like you have a hold in the same way. And I guess it's more symbolic, but how does that work?
The Christmas Tree Organization, and you can go to their website, it's called christmasship.org, pays for the Christmas trees through donations. They provide all the funding for the trees themselves, and we carry between 1,500 or 1,200 and 1,500. I think the largest load was somewhere around 1,500 while I was on board, and have been doing this obviously over the last 22 years. This is the 22nd year that we did it early this year. So they collect donations. They pay for the trees. They have used several Christmas tree providers over the last two decades. And then up until recently, and I hope this continues, there were trees that were cut down by Thompson, Michigan folks that went out in the woods and cut these trees down. There's about 50 of them. And they would attach a personal note from their family to whatever deserving family in Chicago got the tree itself. And to me, that was one of the most special parts of this whole event, was that connection between the folks in the UP of Michigan and the folks that got the trees in Chicago. And so we'd carry those as well as the other ones that were purchased from Christmas Tree Farms. We would load them on. The old Mackinac would hand over hand them up to the stern of the vessel and tie them on, use cargo nets. And, as we got busier with the multi-purpose role of the new Mackinac, we would have them delivered to our moorings here there in Sheboygan, bundle them up and use a cargo net, the modern crane, to lift them and hoist them up to the back deck of the Mackinac. So as we were working buoys on the buoy deck on our way down, the trees would be safely tucked away and nestled back on the stern of the ship. And that's where they're offloaded from once we arrive in Chicago.
Well, you know, first of all, the fact that your guys are volunteering their time to also deal with the Christmas trees is really sweet. And then also the fact that you can combine, you know, a wonderful nonprofit, you know, helping folks in Chicago with your usual business. I mean, it wasn't like you were going out of your way and, you know, you just, well, we have to go down there. Let's take down. We got to go down and do buoy tending. Let's take them down. So today, those trees are handed out, are donated, right, to families in need in Chicago?
That's correct. So the Chicago Christmas Tree Ship Committee partners with Ada S. McKinley Community Services, and they determine which deserving families are going to get those Christmas tree ships. I think they started off with something like 13 different partner organizations, and now they're up to 100 different partner organizations there in Chicago that they help, and just a fantastic organization. And so that, you know, we service the transportation mode in the workforce labor, along with, I would say, Sea Scouts and Sea Cadets from Chicago help offload the trees as well. And there are a lot of different organizations that that help during that time, using the Mackinac poles in on Friday. Folks from multiple organizations come on board, including the Island Goat Society, come on board and help light the ship up, put lights on the ship and decorate the ship. And then the ship is available and open for a couple of kid tours on the ship itself. Obviously, the last couple of years have been a little bit different, but hopefully, you know, wonderfully this year, they were allowed to open the vessel up for some tours. And then the official ceremony is on Saturday morning.
Where do you dock when you go to Chicago?
Well, right at the west face on Navy Pier. So all the way in, just south of the Navy Pier, the new Christmas tree ship comes in and docks right there.
That's wonderful. Dr. Karamanski, you talked about the Rouse Simmons and the history of the Rouse Simmons, and also indicated that she floundered and sank. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
The last tragic voyage of the Rouse Simmons, or Chicago's Christmas tree ship, is the stuff of legend, because the vessel was lost with all hands. And so why the vessel sank has been one of those sort of enduring mysteries of the Great Lakes. And the fact that she died taking 17 souls with her underscored the tragedy of her last voyage.
Yeah, it is a sad ending to a ship that, you know, is so much a part of maritime history. Very sad. It also does emphasize that the lakes are dangerous, and you got to know what you're doing when you sail them. We've talked about it before. And let me just give a side mention to this, that just yesterday, as a matter of fact, I was on a phone call with navigation folks that I work with in the government. And one of your successors on the Mackinac, Captain Smith, Captain John Stone was on the phone. He's come back post-retirement doing navigation again. And he first reminded me to say that he was actually the best captain and most important captain on the Mackinac. And why am I talking to you instead of him? But be that as it may, I said, well, that's for another day. But he mentioned that there was a prediction of 35-foot waves on Lake Superior because of extraordinary winds coming through. Now, I don't know if they made 35 feet, but when I talked to my brother, when we interviewed him, he said the largest wave he'd seen was 20 feet. And then Captain Stone said he saw an 18-footer on Superior. So just to kind of underscore how extraordinary the lakes are, and it people think they're lakes, you know, kind of like just a lake, but they are every bit as dangerous and challenging as an ocean. So the Rouse Simmons sank, and I'm guessing that they really didn't know where she sank for a long 100 years.
Just to underscore what you just mentioned, Helen, the men who sailed the Christmas tree ships understood the danger that they were going through. There were a lot of Christmas tree ships that had sunk before the Rouse Simmons. And indeed, August Juneman, who captained one of the captains of the Rouse Simmons, he lost his brother in 1898, just off the shore of Glencoe, Illinois, the north suburb of Chicago, on a Christmas tree ship that sank with all hands. So sailing the lakes in November, December was literally participating in a lottery of death. But the profits could be considerable. You could get a Christmas tree either bought from the local people or cut yourself for like a penny or two in cost, and then sell it in Chicago for 75 cents. So they were in the position to be able to make several thousand dollars to keep alive a tradition that was very much valued, particularly by the German-American community in Chicago. But they understood that this was highly risky.
So when did the Rouse Simmons sink, and when was the shipwreck discovered?
So while the vessel sank either on the 22nd or 23rd of November 1912, and there were all sorts of reports about maybe there were survivors, there were people who claimed to have been survivors, there was a message found in a bottle from someone who was on the vessel talking about the distress it was in that may have been erroneous and fabricated. But it wasn't until 1971 that a recreational diver, actually looking for another vessel that had sunk, discovered the Rouse Simmons. And what did he find in the hold of the vessel but the complete cargo of Christmas trees that had been loaded way back in 1912.
Well, I think that's because of the fresh water, right? Or was it so deep and no oxygen down there? Like, how far down was she found?
She was in about 150 feet of water.
Wow. Did the wreckage give any clues as to how she sank? Or?
Regrettably, nothing conclusive. Certainly, the wreckage has been gone over by many of other divers since that time. And, you know, we just haven't been able to do a conclusive forensic analysis that helps us. But most likely, this was a vessel that was not in the most seaworthy condition to begin with. And Captain Schuneman made the mistake of extending the deckhouse on the vessel to be able to carry more Christmas trees. In addition to piling Christmas trees then on this deckhouse, there was a fear that the vessel was going to be top heavy. And you talk about some of those waves that we know can happen on Lake Michigan, 15, 18 feet high. That would have put the vessel in a really precarious position.
Whereabouts is the wreckage? I mean, in like what part of Lake Michigan?
So this would be around Two Rivers, Wisconsin. So in the area, say, around Manitowoc, at the base, near the base of the Dora Peninsula. And it's an area that has recently been established by the National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration as an underwater refuge because of all the shipwrecks that lie on the bottom of Lake Michigan in that area.
Yeah, I read that, and I kind of want to have those folks on to talk about shipwrecks and that whole sanctuary there. In the last podcast, Lighthouse, we talked about Door County and that whole Devil's Triangle of area that's pretty dangerous and why you needed lighthouses, obviously, why it was so treacherous. Now, whether that is where the ship sank, it, you know, I guess the point is that it is... It you know, you had to really want to do that business. It's not for the faint of heart. I think even today, being a merchant mariner is not for the faint of heart, but it's an important work. But obviously, modifying the boat may have contributed. And also, though, it's sad because at that point, then didn't the whole Christmas tree ship tradition kind of end at that point?
Not quite. After losing her brother-in-law and husband to Christmas trees, Barbara Schuneman, August Schuneman's widow, kept the tradition alive. And a couple of times she brought in schooners, but mainly she began to bring the Christmas trees to Chicago by rail and then sell them from the deck of schooners. And she continued this business with her daughters till 1933.
Wow. So now, was this schooner, the deck of the schooner that they used, it was just a schooner that was there all the time and it became the background for selling Christmas trees? Or was it a ship that was applying the trade and somehow, was it a ship that was always there or a ship in business?
Well, by the time we get to the 1920s and 30s, in the backwaters of the Port of Chicago, up the North Branch or South Branch of the Chicago River, there were a lot of derelict schooners. That really owners had abandoned, but not quite. And every once in a while, the Port Authority would have to take some of these derelict vessels out into Lake Michigan and just sink them so that they weren't, you know, clogging up space along the river. So there were plenty of schooners that could be towed into place and would pass for being a seaworthy vessel.
Yeah, I get that. And of course, you know, we talked about how it was amazing how even in the early 1900s, you still had the sailing ships, even still going through the Welland Canal, just to get from Lake Ontario to Lake Erie. And that's you're trying to imagine what that looked like and how they did it. So Scott, you just recently went to a Christmas tree. You kind of talked about this a little bit, ceremony in Chicago. When was that, and is that an annual thing?
It definitely is an annual thing. I've been privileged to, since I work and live closely to Chicago, been able to go there a couple of times. It's the first Saturday in December. The official ceremony is about 10 o'clock right there at Navy Pier, and they have a wonderful ceremony attended by quite a few people. It's a great crowd this year. Even through the issues we're dealing with. You know, they have the Coast Guard Academy Glee Club was there to sing and to provide it entertainment, as well as Lee Murdoch, who's the official balladeer of the Christmas tree ship. And they have a wonderful ceremony there to hand off the trees between the U.S. Coast Guard Christmas Tree Committee and the Ada S. McKinley Community Services. So it is an annual event, as well as on the trip down, and this is a little known thing that we do, and being mariners, obviously, on the Mackinac is once we've departed northern Lake Michigan, we take some boughs that we gather, which sometimes fall off with loading the trees. We usually form a wreath that we stop at the last known position of where the Ralph Simmons went down, and we hold a small solemn ceremony for those souls that we lost back in 1912. And then we continue our drive.
Wow, that's a lovely tradition. As you mentioned, you can find out more about that at christmasship.org, which is a great site, and you can see the folks from Coast Guard. And on the front, there's a really great picture of the Mackinac docked at Navy Pier. And if people want to learn more about the Mackinac, where would they go, Scott? And where is she, the current Mackinac, where is she homeported?
So she is homeported in Sheboygan, Michigan, Sheboygan with a C. And up in the top of the Mitt, up there in the lower part of Michigan. That's where the old Mackinac was home ported. It's where the current Mackinac is home ported. And she can go to the Coast Guard website to learn more about that ship and its unique capabilities and crew.
That's great. What are you doing these days to keep yourself busy?
Keeping myself busy. So I am employed by Hornblower Group, which is a leader for both excursions, waterborne excursions, and transportation in the U.S., Canada, and U.K. We have vessels there. I've now got 227 vessels that I help run and make sure that they're all safe on the maritime side of that. I'm the senior vice president for marine operations. Including vessels in Chicago. So we have the Odysseys and the Spirits, as well as the Sea Dogs there in Chicago.
Well, they got the right operations guy and to run all of those ships. So happy for them and happy for you. Dr. Karamanski, could you just, as we begin to close this podcast, how would you express how maritime history, what it's done for the lakes or Chicago, and what do you think its future is today?
I think that maritime history plays a valuable role in creating a sense of community for the towns and cities that are along the lake. It's a reminder of their reason for existence, their origin. And the lakes are not just, today, recreation dominates our perception of the lakes, but that there was this earlier tradition in which they were absolutely central to the economy of the region and even to the fate of the nation, when you think of the tremendous contribution that the Great Lakes maritime and shoreline industries had in winning World War II. So things like the lighthouses that survive and the harbors, which are now used for recreation, I think they become places of memory where this connection can be nurtured. And important in that same for that same reason are the region's maritime museums. There's so many wonderful small maritime museums around the Great Lakes. And I would encourage all your readers to come to the south side of Chicago on the south branch of the Chicago River, where the Chicago Maritime Museum is located. We have a model of the Christmas tree ship there. We have Charles Vickery's paintings of the ship, as well as a lot of other interesting exhibits that I'm sure would engage them if they're interested in the lakes.
Thank you. Is there a website for that?
Absolutely. Just Google Chicago Maritime Museum, and that search engine will take you right to our website with hours of operation, where you can enjoy the many things we have loaded on the website.
It's very interactive and it's terrific. Now, I wanted to give you a plug for all of the books you've written, but I have to confess, there's a lot of them. All you got to do is Google Dr. Theodore Karamanski, and even on Amazon, there must be a dozen that come up. But sir, I did want to note that you've also written a couple of books about Native Americans and regional communities. I really hope you can come back to talk about that a little bit sometime, because I think I really do want to spend a little more time talking about the Native Americans and history in the Great Lakes.
I'd be happy to do it.
Dr. Karamanski, Captain Smith, thank you so much for joining us.
This wraps up another episode of North Coast Chronicles Tales from the Great Lakes. Thank you to the American Shoreline Podcast Network for hosting us, and Tyler Buckingham for being a great partner. I'd love to hear from our listeners. Send me your comments, ideas for future podcasts, or to be a sponsor to northcoastchronicles@gmail.com.
The conversation and opinions expressed on North Coast Chronicles do not necessarily represent the opinion of the U.S. Department of Transportation.
Join us next time when we are joined by the premier interpreter of songs and tales about the Great Lakes, singer-musician Lee Murdoch. Lee will help us discover the drama and inspiration in the lives of sailors and fishermen, lighthouse keepers, ghosts, shipwrecks, outlaws, and everyday heroes of the Great Lakes. Until then, be good to one another.